fraud detection is super fun. It's fun to unravel and it's fun to do that detective work. It's not super fun for the client unless we get a really good result.
You're listening to Heather Culp, a bankruptcy attorney, receiver, and commercial litigator. Welcome to the Fraud Fighter Podcast.
I work with forensic accountants on a regular basis. I'll look at it and think, this doesn't look right. Things are missing. And then when you ask for the missing things, you get a bunch of BS in return. Soft skills are just as important as certifications and your resume skills.
In this episode, we discuss the difference between bankruptcy and receivership, the role and the need of a forensic accountant and a receivership, the critical skills and credentials needed to help a receiver, and the value of a mentor and sponsor. She is a graduate from the University of Kentucky Law School. She is a partner with Essek Richards in Charlotte. She focuses on bankruptcy and commercial litigation. Heather Culp, welcome to the Fraud Fighter Podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
It's absolutely my pleasure to have you. How did you choose law as a profession?
So I'm going to date myself when I answer that one. I am in my late 40s, which means when I was in junior high school, I was a big fan of LA Law. My dad and I watched religiously, didn't miss an episode, and I thought, this looks really exciting, being a lawyer, and I think I could do it. So a big part of it, I'm a little embarrassed to admit, is just TV when I was growing up. But the other part of it is I participated in my junior high school and high school mock trial team and had really great teachers and really great local lawyers who taught us and encouraged us and mentored us and, you know, told me they thought that this was something that I could do. And I believed them. And I'd say it was a combination of those two things and a dash of being an oldest child and being a little bit bossy. You throw all that together and here I am. And thankfully, it's all worked out okay.
What made you go into bankruptcy in commercial litigation?
I have done several types of law during my career, which I think is not that unusual. It might be surprising to people who are not lawyers, but I've been practicing since 1997, so I guess a little over 23 years now. And when I moved to North Carolina, I moved to Charlotte in 2002, I had not done any bankruptcy work at all. But I was hired by a law firm here in Charlotte that did a variety of litigation, and one of those was bankruptcy and bankruptcy litigation. And after working there for a while, the gentleman who was the senior partner of the firm at the time, Rick Mitchell, he was a Chapter 7 bankruptcy trustee. He was a receiver and just very well known, well respected, and experienced in this particular corner of the law. And as often happens, I think, I had some free time at work and he needed extra help. And he asked me one day if I would be willing to try to learn this area and help him out. And I loved it. He was a great teacher, a great mentor, a great lawyer, especially early in my practice. And I found the work just really interesting and rewarding. And the other part of it is something that I think is probably a well-kept secret to some extent, but bankruptcy lawyers are just really practical, really creative people. There's often not, you know, a big pot of money to fund a lot of fancy exploratory negotiations and fishing expeditions and things like that. I guess what I'm not saying very well and trying to say is that everybody on all sides of the problem or the equation is interested in a quick and cost-effective and practical resolution. So it's just really nice down-to-earth people to work with who are very smart and very experienced and very fun to deal with. So I think for all those reasons, after trying it out, I have stuck with it for a long time now.
There's not many young women in bankruptcy. It's just unusual, I guess. It's per se, when you walk into a room, it's probably a bunch of a lot of old guys.
Yes, I would say so. And And it's funny, my instinct was to correct you a little bit because I'm almost 48, which is not young.
It is in the bankruptcy world.
It is. Yes, it is. So it is unusual. And I would say it was more of a challenge earlier in my career when I was a lot younger, when people didn't really know me and I was still kind of proving myself and showing who I am. Definitely, it was more of a challenge then. I don't find it to be much of a challenge now, particularly people who are regulars in the system. There's a small percentage of men who get caught up in the system, either they're debtors or they're creditors in bankruptcy court or in a receivership or similar proceeding, and they do not like women having control over any aspect of their property or their affairs or really even asking about it. It's not something that happens often, but when it does happen, it can be kind of jarring and kind of concerning. I have to kind of watch myself a little extra carefully. But all of that being said, it's never a dull moment, and it's a good way to make a living.
Speaking of receivership, do you have any experience in receivership? I'm assuming it's different than bankruptcy.
It is different. Bankruptcy is part of the federal statutes. There's the bankruptcy code, and the bankruptcy court is part of the federal court system. It's a standalone court with its own separate judges, but it's generally housed, you know, in the federal court and certainly part of the federal court system. Receiverships are different, at least the receiverships that I have handled, and that's what I'm hoping that we can talk about today. To the extent that we talk about receiverships, it's going to be my experience in North Carolina receiverships. There are all kinds of receiverships and all kinds of statutes that authorize receiverships, but my experience has been being appointed by a North Carolina court to be a receiver over North Carolina individual or company under the North Carolina statute. So that's the difference. It's a different law. It's a different court that's overseeing me and making sure I discharge my responsibilities and do things the right way. A different court. It's very different. So that's a great question.
So what exactly is a receivership? I'm assuming it's a judge that hires you to do receivership. What are your duties?
Yeah, it's a judge that appoints receivers. Occasionally, there is a consent order that's entered, meaning nobody's fighting about this. Everybody agrees who's involved that a receiver should be appointed, but that's fairly rare. Usually, somebody is resisting that. So it's a judge that appoints a receiver, and the concept is that the receiver is a neutral professional who is serving in a fiduciary capacity, you know, with certain responsibilities and oversight, basically to see a problem through. There are lots of reasons to appoint a receiver. The most common ones in my experience as a receiver and as an attorney for other receivers are these. One is when a company is breaking up, they're unable to go forward for various reasons. Sometimes it could be shareholder deadlock, or if it's an LLC member deadlock. Classic example is a 50-50 membership LLC, meaning there's two members and they each have equal authority and voting rights and all of that. Well, if they get into a disagreement, it can be a problem such that, you know, the LLC can't go forward and can't conduct its business. So one of the grounds is being appointed to handle the affairs of the company and wind it up, collect debts that are owed, pay creditors, liquidate property, handle any lawsuits that need to be filed or answered, and basically file an inventory of what was done, who's going to be paid, and with what and why, and kind of see all that through and then dissolve the company. That's the technical term. Another reason is if there's an insolvent corporation, its debts exceed its assets, to close that down. Another example or another reason to have a receiver appointed is to enforce and collect on a judgment. And that, I think, was my first appointment. And I think it's something that's pretty easy to wrap your arms and your brain around. There was someone here in town who had gotten a pretty significant judgment against an individual and was having some trouble collecting that, and was able to demonstrate to me there's various real estate here in town that has enough equity in it that if it were sold and the receiver were compensated, there would still be plenty of money left over to pay the judgment. And that's what we wound up doing there. You can have a sheriff sell real estate to satisfy a judgment, but a receiver is going to have wider authority and better ability to get a higher price. As you might imagine, you know, a sale at the courthouse is probably going to be a fire sale value, whereas I actually hired a realtor and marketed it and got a good price. So that's a ground. Another ground or another reason is to preserve property or the value of property pending litigation. I was appointed on that ground once there was a dispute over a strip mall here in town, a shopping center. There was a dispute over whether a lease had been breached and whether the property should go back to the control of the landlord or whether the tenant should stay in place. And the tenant was subleasing to various tenants. So I was appointed just to collect the rents, pay the bills to keep the shopping center open and operating, and manage the property while the judge worked through that dispute. That's another ground. And the final ground that I think is most common and that I see most often is to foreclose on or enforce a security agreement. And an example of that, a business here in town had taken out a line of credit and as collateral had given the lender a lien on all of its accounts receivable, and the loan went into default. And, you know, because the security agreement said that the borrower consented to the appointment of a receiver to collect the receivables to pay off the debt, that's one where I was appointed by a consent order. So, I mean, there are other grounds, but those are by far the most common and the ones that I have the most experience with. And I think, just again, the big idea is to have someone who's qualified and knows what they're doing and has experience in this particular area and can see that task through. That's what I do. That's a good chunk of my work on a day-to-day basis.
Does a receiver typically have to be an attorney, or is it just usually an attorney?
That's a really good question. There is no requirement to be an attorney, and it's going to depend on the particular facts and issues, legal issues involved in the case as to who is going to be the best fit. Sometimes an attorney makes the most sense, particularly if there's a lot of litigation to handle or particular legal issues to deal with. But other times I have seen or advocated for the appointment of a property manager if it's just real estate management. There's no reason to pay an attorney possibly a higher rate or a higher commission when it's something that someone else is better suited to do, probably at a much cheaper rate. Accountants and CPAs are often appointed receivers, particularly if the books and records are a mess and if tax returns have not been filed and there are tax issues to deal with. And insolvency professionals are often appointed as receivers as well. So no requirement for any particular background. You just need to be able to demonstrate under the statute really that you have the right skills and experience to do the job.
You are talking about needing professional help sometimes to do your job as a receiver. Or is there a point in time where there's a need for a forensic accountant in these type of situations?
Yeah, there can be. I won't say, you know, every receivership requires that or every bankruptcy case or every commercial lawsuit, but I work with forensic accountants on a regular basis on my cases. In thinking about your question, I think what comes to mind is I rely on forensic accountants in both my client cases, the cases, you know, where I have a private party that I'm representing, and in my receivership and bankruptcy cases where I'm either the court-appointed receiver or the court-appointed trustee, to help me with a few issues. One is fraud detection. That's a pretty big category. I guess what I have in mind is looking for evidence of self-dealing, owners or managers paying themselves too much, paying personal expenses, paying expenses that are out of the ordinary course, using corporate funds, you know, whether it's properly booked or not, that can be a problem. Diversion of corporate opportunities is a big issue that I tend to see in my cases. That's where, let's say you and I have a business together, we're both members, and one of us gets irritated with the other, or irritated with our overall situation, and opens up a competing business and starts siphoning off customers or clients or sales. Forensic accountants can be very helpful in building that case, going back through records and building that case. Just basic mismanagement. I've seen everything from out and out embezzlement, theft, you know, employees just taking money. And sometimes it's cleverly done and sometimes it's not. That's kind of the extreme end, just all the way down to not having basic controls and processes and procedures in place to do good day-to-day bookkeeping and tax and accounting. Billing fraud is something that forensic accountants can be really helpful in detecting. That can take a wide variety of forms.
Are you talking about like accounts payable, like people, like the controller is billing for an unnecessary service and has a shell corporation out there?
It could be that. What I have more in mind and tend to see or have come up more in my work is I represent a company who has contracted with someone to provide a particular service, and they overcharged, they double charged, they charged and they didn't do the work.
So the customer's billing more than what they should be billing?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Right, gotcha.
And it's usually fraudulent. It's not a mistake. It's not an innocent, a one-off or two-off here. It's a purposeful, or at least that's what I get brought in on when a client has concerns about something. It's usually what we wind up finding is something that was very purposefully done over a long period of time, and we've got to try to rectify that.
Right. When a forensic accountant is needed, what special skills or certifications are you looking for? What exactly are you looking for when you hire one?
Before I answer that, it occurs to me that I probably didn't fully answer your prior question. I don't want to leave the impression that everything that I do on my cases with forensic accountants is like super sexy cloak and dagger stuff.
Well, we completely understand. No one says I want to grow up to be a forensic accountant. That's where all the capes are at. All the forensic accountants got them. There's no more capes available.
And you know, I appreciate that, but the fact is that fraud detection is super fun. I mean, it's super fun. It's not super fun for the client unless we get a really good result. I don't want anyone to have to go through that, but it's fun to unravel and it's fun to do that detective work. But a lot of what I use forensic accountants for is not nearly that exciting or out of the ordinary. It's more gathering and protecting financial data, particularly electronic data. If I'm appointed receiver or am the trustee of a company, particularly, or an owner of a business that appears to have significant value, we're going to need to get a copy of QuickBooks right away. We're going to need to get bank records, tax records, backup documents, payroll records, and things like that. And I'm just an English major. It makes no sense to have me go through all that stuff and see what's going on. So I rely on good forensic accountants to do that work for me. And they also provide litigation support. They can be very helpful early on in a case in assessing it, developing our case theory and our case strategy, seeing if we have a good case if we're the plaintiff or if we have a good defense if we're the defendant, gathering evidence, making sure that I'm asking for the right things in discovery from the other side. They can provide expert witness services, testify before the court if necessary as to causation or damages. And they can help me calculate damages as well. I can say, here's what went wrong, but they can do the math and the calculations and the economic forecasting to provide that answer to the court when it comes up. So now I've forgotten the question that you actually asked me. You'll have to repeat it. I just want to make sure I gave a full and complete answer.
I was asking, when a forensic accountant is needed, what special skills or certifications are you looking for? And maybe it's particular based upon the case that you've got, whether it's a receivership or bankruptcy. I don't know. That's the reason why I was asking is number one, what skills are you looking for, certifications? And then number two, maybe a follow-up is, does it make a difference based upon the type of case you're working with, bankruptcy, receivership, or fill in the blank?
In terms of certifications, obviously I want a CPA. On top of that, if I have my druthers, I have a small group of these types of experts that I regularly go to, and all of them are diplomas of the American Board of Forensic Accounting, and they're all certified in financial forensics. So they have other certifications as well. They might be a certified fraud examiner. There can be some other ones, but these are the three critical ones in my mind, and I think kind of the industry standard. It can be helpful depending on the type of the case. You're spot on. It can be helpful to have someone who's a certified insolvency and reorganization accountant. They can help me spot quickly whether a company that's in distress is worth trying to reorganize or rehabilitate or sell, or whether we just need to shut it down and move on. So it does depend a little bit on the type of the case. Those are kind of the three basics that I look for. And I would say soft skills are just as important as certifications and your resume skills. I think that's true for just about any career in life, and it's certainly true for forensic accountants. In every case, I want and need and expect somebody who's responsive and reliable, is available to help me meet court deadlines or for an arbitration, those deadlines. Litigation can be very fast-paced and can change quickly, so it needs to be somebody who is willing to roll with that. I try to get work done within normal business hours, but I routinely fail and wind up working nights and weekends. And my accountants are usually available. I try not to impose on them, but they have been available outside of hours when I need them to. They need to be good communicators. I think both speaking well, oral communications and writing. A lot of what we do is reports to the court, and you know, they need to be clear and coherent. And I think sometimes that's something that accountants may not realize, particularly early in this corner of the law and of accountancy.
I'm being facetious when I say I'm shocked that you're saying they can't be that introverted. Because most CPAs and accountants have this job because they don't like to deal with people. They don't deal with numbers. Yeah. And so what you're telling me is that there has to be at least a little, some extrovertedness to where they can – they're okay with getting out people and mingling and, frankly, being cross-examined if need be, which, you know, which can be very stressful at sometimes.
Yeah, it can be, and it's not for everybody. I mean, just like some lawyers go to court and some don't, some accountants go to court and some don't. And that is something that I think about when I'm choosing which accountant I want to work with on a particular case. There are some who are better and more comfortable in being what I think of as a consulting role. I will never tell the other side or the court that I'm using them and their opinions and work product will be confidential and produced only to me. But, you know, they help me get organized, and sometimes they tell me, don't go down this road or do go down that road. But more common is exactly what you're saying, hiring a testifying expert. And while most things are resolved short of a trial or outside of the courtroom, it usually takes a lot of work to get to that point. And they will be signing off on written reports or helping me put those together. And you're right, things go the right way or maybe the wrong way, depending on what case it is. They may have to testify in court. And I would say, you know, the last thing that comes to mind in terms of soft skills is having my back and looking out for me. I do that for my own clients as a lawyer. Sometimes the biggest part of my job is saying, you know, don't do that, or you shouldn't do that, or that's not a good idea. And that's often what my regular CPAs, my tax and accounting CPAs for my cases, and my forensic accountants will say is, you know, that's not worth your time, or that's not productive, or that's the wrong way to go. Let's think about this way instead. And that's some of the most valuable advice that I could possibly get. So that's a really important thing, is being upfront and honest and forthright about your thoughts and your recommendations. That's important to me, and I want that.
What advice would you give to someone who's a forensic accountant or wants to assist bankruptcy attorneys or receivers? I mean, what advice would you give to them? Somebody who wants to be in that space.
From my perspective and my experience, the best thing to do is to network in a classy and a quality way. And so there are some do's and some don'ts there. I'm pretty active on LinkedIn. I don't have any other social media except for Goodreads.com. I put on there what books I'm reading, as if anyone cares about any of that. But I'm pretty active on LinkedIn, and a kind of a pet peeve of mine, I guess, is to get an in-mail, you know, an email in my LinkedIn box from someone I've never met and don't know anything about and don't have any mutual connections with, saying, I do such and such. Can we have a 15-minute call next week? I mean, I don't have time for that. I sound very grouchy. Maybe I am very grouchy. It's just not, in my experience, it's not a very good way to get business. What I think works is if you have someone who can make introductions for you or can ask people, tell people, hey, I know XYZ accountant and he or she has really helped me. I think they could help you. Could I make a connection? I'm always going to say yes to that. I mean, that's just a no-brainer. The other thing is most of the forensic accountants that I have met and have used, I have found them through either court. They've been involved in a case on the other side and I liked them and respected how they handled things. Or they have spoken at a seminar that I've attended or written in a professional journal or publication that I read. The North Carolina Bar Association and the Mecklenburg County Bar both have seminars, you know, on a weekly, if not daily basis on all types of the law and often have a CPA or a forensic accountant or an IRS agent or a North Carolina Department of Revenue agent or attorney come talk to us about interesting issues or unusual issues or changes in the law. And that's, I think, an easy way for someone who's trying to get into the field or stay in the field to kind of show, hey, I know what I'm talking about. I'm experienced. You can trust me and I can help you. So those would be kind of top of mind tips for me is to speak and to write, to ask for introductions. If you have a website or if you have a blog, post things, post on LinkedIn. All of that stuff catches my eye. And if I see somebody that looks really good, I'll email them or I'll shoot them a LinkedIn email or I'll ask for their resume or see if we can set up a call. Those in my mind are pretty easy and cost-effective, good ways to market yourself.
If you could look into a crystal ball, where do you see that industry going or in particularly helping people like yourself, like bankruptcy attorneys and receiverships and commercial litigators? Is the field changing for you? Are you requesting more technology experience or certain things?
So I think you hit the nail on the head. Technology and electronic data is just more and more evolving and it can make the job easier and more cost effective for the client, whether I'm the client because I'm the receiver or the bankruptcy trustee, or, you know, I'm the lawyer for the private client. I mean, we just, all of us generate so much electronic data in a day, whether we intend to or not. And there's all kinds of clues and information and all of that. So keeping up with technology that can make it easier to harness that, to marshal it, to get it together and sort through it. I personally think of that as more of a lawyer job, but that could be because I'm not as educated as I should be on the accounting end. I mean, certainly my CPAs in my cases tell me we need this, 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 and this, get these records or request these records or get an order getting these records and these information. Now, what they do with it in their offices, what software they have and how they work through things, I don't particularly know unless I need to know, and it's pretty rare that I need to know. So there's an idea for a future podcast. Maybe you can educate me on that somewhat. But definitely, you are hitting the nail on the head.
Are you asking what technology to use, like software?
Absolutely. Yep.
Well, I did have a guest a few episodes ago that talked about Quicken and how he uses it, and it's very easy. It's not much bells and whistles to it, but it gets the job done. Because if you don't care about the accounts receivable, accounts payable, it's just pure check register, and you have to recreate it. It was it's what he uses, which is, I would never thought about that. But yeah.
That's good to know.
Yep.
Quicken. That's very interesting.
Because you can input the data via an Excel spreadsheet, import or export it, mm-hmm. And it's like $40. But he buys it for every
and
client
that's
he's got.
From bank statements?
Yep. You take your bank statements, you take your bank statements, you scan it in using a certain software, And then you take that data and then import it into Quicken, and then you can play around with it and reconcile it and put your own categories on it and da-da-da-da-da-da and have your reports. And he does multi-million dollar cases with it.
That's amazing.
Yes, I thought it was fantastic. Kevin
Hanf.
That's
a real value add.
It's Kevin Hanf.
Yeah,
and it's episode, I can't think of it now. It's like 3 or 4 episodes ago. But anyways.
Okay. Well, I'll look out for that one. I mean, the analogy to that, and you probably know because you're in this space too. I mean, when I was a brand new baby lawyer, when we were doing document review, it meant going to a dusty, nasty warehouse somewhere and going through boxes one by one and putting post-its on things and making lists. And if it's a small case, that's probably still the most efficient way to do things. But for a bigger case, it's an absolute must to have an e-discovery, electronic discovery partner who has software where you can upload to the platform all of this electronic data, and they will do their coding, and then you can search it for certain words or certain terms or certain phrases or sender, you know, any sort that you want to do, you can do. And just, I mean, that is, it's very much like what you're talking about with Quicken. It's such a game changer. It's so much more efficient.
What advice would you give to a fraud examiner who's just starting, who's interested in forensic accounting or starting on their own? If a college graduate or soon thereafter a college graduate, maybe a young 20, young 30-year-old person says, you know what, I want to get in this space, what would you recommend to them?
Ideally, find a mentor. Well, I think that's good advice for anybody. I kind of lapse into corporate speak sometimes, but a mentor and a sponsor, and those are two different things. Mentor is someone you can go to with questions and who cheers you on and tells you, yes, you can do this, or maybe that's not such a good idea because you don't have the experience and the judgment to do that yourself. Or if you get to be my stage of the career, I mean, I still have mentors. It's not like we get to where we know everything and have all the answers. It's still good to bounce ideas and have a check. So one piece of advice would be to have a mentor. And I think the other piece of advice would be to have a sponsor, and that's someone who makes introductions for you and tries to help you get business, tells potential clients, you know, I know Heather very well. She would take very good care of you. You know, she helped me with X, Y, and Z, and I have the utmost confidence in her. That's what lawyers that I worked with early in my career did for me, and it was invaluable. And I would just say again, practice makes perfect. Harkening back to what we talked about earlier, you know, work on your writing and your speaking skills. If my experience is accountants in particular don't feel as confident in their writing skills and in their speaking skills. So the more you do it, the more comfortable you get. And I think that would serve you very well. Even if you have no intention of ever going to a courtroom or being in a deposition, those skills are important.
In my previous episode, I talked about skill sets get you in the door, but relationships is what gets the job. It's really what it comes down to. People are comfortable with who you are. I mean, after a while, there's a certain level of expertise that's out there. Okay, well, then it all becomes, do I like you? And do I trust you?
Yep.
And there's those other elements other than just you are a 4.0 or 5.0 person in college.
Absolutely.
And writing skills, oh, yes, trust me. Be able to prove what you said is going on is just huge in a way that everybody understands what you're talking about versus lawyer speak or accounting speak is also very huge. I totally agree with you. Tell me about a fraud investigation. I know you probably have some client confidentialities to deal with that you're most proud of or something that made a difference in your career.
Well, keeping in this space, because I've handled all types of different cases, and there have been different wins and different losses that mean things for different reasons. But one of the cases that comes to mind, or a handful of cases, is where we discovered some billing fraud. And using that term here, what I'm talking about is invoice swapping. Customer orders a particular product and pays for the product, and the product is shipped. You know, we go back through it. There's some time lag, and it's a little bit complicated and probably not that interesting. But what I did was have a forensic accountant go through all of these records, go through the purchase order, the payment record, the bill of lading, the invoice and the bank record showing what was paid for, and we were able to show that invoices were swapped, that my client ordered something at a much lower price. We were told that the market had changed and tariffs had changed and certain things had changed, and there was no avoiding it. The cost had to go up. And what we found out that was totally fraudulent. They were sticking us with invoices from other projects that were higher, and that shouldn't have happened. So
is this a product that the client's buying?
It's a product.
Make sure I got this right. So it's a product that they go to the salesman. I want X. And the salesman says, oh, X is available, but whew, boy, times are tough. It's going to be a lot more money than what X is anymore. The cost is for X has gone extremely high. And so the customer still gets this product, correct?
Right.
But they're paying a higher price than what the market should hold.
That's right.
Okay. And the difference...
You know, we're not talking about a markup. There can be a markup on things, and that's not illegal or inappropriate. But there was more to the deal than that. Certain promises were made and representations were made, and that's exactly how it shook out.
Okay, so the terms or maybe the quality of the product weren't there, but they were promised to be there.
Right.
Okay, that makes sense. I mean, I understand we have to be a little bit super secretive. I'm just trying to get an idea of, well, so what? You always have to have a markup. Someone's got to make a profit, but there's a lie on the other end regarding maybe the quality of the work or maybe the source of the product came from.
Yeah.
I'm buying it from U.S., United States, and it ends up being in China, and it's different, you know. It's not the type of metal. It's tin, not gold. I mean, yeah, I understand.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So
yes,
you had
all of those factors can come into play. That's right.
So what was the outcome?
And that's not something that I would have discovered on my own. You know, in cases where that kind of thing happens, the client has an itch. And that's what one of the CPAs that I use often, that's how he puts it. He'll look at things, and if he gets an itch, something suspicious, and he wants to scratch it. So the client will have an itch, and I'll look at it and think, this doesn't look right. We're not getting the whole purchase order. The back is missing with different terms. And then we're getting an amended purchase order, but we don't have the amendment that was in between. It's like things are missing. I mean, that's easy for me to spot, for a lay person to spot. And then when you ask for the missing things, you get a bunch of BS in return. Well, we can't find it, or that person doesn't work here anymore, or why do you need that? You couldn't possibly need that. Well, then you really get an itch. So those are the kinds of things that are fun to work on. And there's not always a pot of gold at the end of the path, but sometimes there is, and that's a great feeling.
What was the outcome of that?
It was good. Let's leave it there. It was good.
I wasn't sure if there's a criminal aspect to it.
No, there was no criminal aspect. And sometimes there is, but the one I'm thinking of, no. And that's pretty rare. It's not unheard of, but it's pretty rare that there's a criminal aspect. In my case, it has happened.
I would say you just hadn't sold it well enough to the prosecutors. That's my opinion on the matter.
Yes. I mean, it either has to be an enormous number.
If there's great intent, a big dollar amount, there's some prosecutor out there that'll take it.
Yeah, it needs to be an enormous dollar amount, or in my experience, an issue of local importance. And, you know,
correct,
particularly at the U.S. Attorney's Office, that can change from year to year, from administration to administration.
Right.
But I have had a couple of cases where, you know, I have talked to a criminal defense attorney in town, hire them on a consulting basis, and they'll take a look and say, oh, this is pretty bad, but they're probably not going to care about this. Or this is pretty bad, and this particular tariff, or this particular country, or this particular industry, or this particular individual is on their radar or high on their priority list. So that's a really good point. It's going to depend a lot on the priorities of the local office.
What do you wish you had known when you started?
I wish I had taken... I'm a little embarrassed to say this, but I don't think it's that unusual. I wish I had taken a basic accounting class in college. I did not do that. I mean, there's a lot of people, a lot of lawyers like me, bad at math, phobic about math and science, just kind of stick with the humanities. And I wish that when I had come out of college, both for personal and professional reasons, I had had a basic education on how to read financial statements. I mean, I've learned that through life experience the hard way and through good lawyers and good CPAs showing me the ropes and doing some of my own research and education. But I think just basic financial literacy is a good thing. And the other thing is, I wish I knew more about Excel spreadsheets. I'm very envious of Excel whizzes. I still rely on our staff here at the office who are so great that I work with to set those fields up and those formulas and to check them. Those are the two things that I think if I could go back in time and have a do-over, I would focus hard on.
Looking back on your career, what was the biggest mistake or lost opportunity?
I mean, that's probably, I would have the same answer to that question, is just not having good basic financial education and financial tools. I mean, I came out of school, I could certainly balance a checkbook and do file my own tax returns and stuff like that. But a little bit more advanced accounting and tax education would have been helpful. I did take tax in law school, and I learned an awful lot there. I had a good teacher and liked that class more than I thought I would. But I think it's peculiar probably to bankruptcy lawyers and maybe to criminal lawyers too, but particularly to bankruptcy lawyers who tend to represent debtors, which is what I do. You know, I tend to represent the people and the couples and the individuals who can't pay their bills in full. I tell them, and have taken it to heart myself because I believe it, we can't change what's behind us. All we can do is look ahead and try to make the best decisions about how to go forward. So fortunately, I just don't have a lot of big regrets. I don't have very many small ones either. I often go home at the end of the day wishing I'd done a little something differently or said something differently. But it's not really a regret. It's more of, I probably could have done that better. So I don't know what that says about me. If it says that I should have more remorse or be more conscious or what, but I really don't have any, or not any big ones for sure.
Very good. You ready for the final four questions?
Absolutely. Lay them on me.
You're a bankruptcy lawyer, you're receivership, commercial litigation, you're a partner.
Right.
What's your biggest motivation now?
I have two answers. The politically incorrect answer is to make money. I don't want to leave you or your listeners with the impression that I'm the stereotypical lawyer, the reason why we have lawyer jokes, that I just get up to make as much money as possible all day, every day. That's not the case. But I have done a lot of pro bono work. I've done a lot of volunteer work. I've done a lot of community service work. I try to be a good friend and law partner and colleague and member of the bar. And that just involves a lot of unpaid work. And I'm okay with that. And I'll continue to do that. But we go to work every day to make money. So I try to, more than ever, choose my cases wisely, choose to represent clients, and choose to accept receivership appointments where I feel like I'm going to add value. My work is going to lead to something good for the system, for everyone, for the creditors, for whoever the parties are, but also ones where I'm going to be fairly compensated. One thing that's different between receiverships and bankruptcy is I can generally turn down a receivership, and I do turn them down. So a lawyer or someone else in town will call me and say, we need a receiver for this case. Would you be interested? And I'm going to do some digging to find out whether there's anything there to pay me. I mean, are there assets over and above what needs to go to creditors to pay me? Early in my career, I would take not lucrative cases because I wanted to learn and I wanted to get experience. And I'm not doing that so much now. But the bankruptcy system is different. I'm a Chapter 7 trustee, which means I'm on rotation on a regular basis to be appointed to administer bankruptcy cases. And there's no picking and choosing there unless you have a conflict of interest that prevents you from serving. So we're expected to take those even if they're dogs, even if we're not going to make any money off of them. So I just try every day to balance all of that out and make a good decision for my career, both financially and for my family. And I guess the other thing is what motivates me, and I would imagine what motivates you and a lot of professionals later in their career is, you know, we're often competing against ourselves. We have good experience and good skills, and we want to do the best job that we possibly can. So I don't compare myself much to other people who do the same things as me as I do. I try more just to take care of my own business in the best way that I know how, if that makes sense.
What books have changed your life or thinking? What have you read that somehow, you know what? Wow, that was good.
I probably am telling more about this issue, this part of my personality than I should, but tying back our discussion just a minute ago, I read Give and Take by Adam Grant probably 2 or 3 years ago now, and still refer to it on a pretty regular basis. It's a great book, and it's the concept is pretty simple. It's that there are three types of people in the world. There are givers, and there are takers, and there are people who are fairly neutral. And figuring out what type of person you are and figuring out how to make the best of that, but minimize the downside of it, can make a difference. And when I took his quiz, I'm like, all giver, no taker, and not very neutral. So it goes back to, I went to law school in part to make a difference and to help people and all those kind of idealistic principles. And I'm very fortunate working where I am that I have a lot of autonomy to make the decisions about what I want to do and how I want to work and spend my day and the kinds of things I want to work on. Basically, as long as I pay my share of the bills here and I'm a good person, they're not going to have any problem with it. So I have to guard against not doing too much fun, you know, or rewarding not paying work and making sure that I'm making money and paying the bills. So that book has helped me kind of realize that that is something that I need to work on and have worked on. And here we are.
Share something that you've purchased in the last 12 months, less than $100. If it's good enough for Heather, it's good enough for the world, that you enjoyed or made your job easier.
So this is probably not the greatest answer because it's not technology-based, and I don't think it has universal appeal. But I bought the book Checklists for Lawyers by Frank Ramos through the American Bar Association, and it's what it sounds like. It's all kinds of sample checklists to make your day-to-day life easier as a lawyer, and it's everything from law firm management to running your cases to marketing to paying the law firm bills. And it's really a great book. You know, if you're not a lawyer, it may not help you very much. But a similar book that I'm also a big fan of is, you probably are familiar with it, The Checklist Manifesto by Dr. Atul Gawande. Great, great, great book. I mean, he just makes a great case for how reducing the steps that need to be done to get something done right the first time, how reducing that into writing and sharing it with the right people is going to cut out a lot of waste and a lot of mistakes. He did this he's a physician in the context of a hospital that he was working at and running. And it's made a big difference. I'm a big fan of those kinds of things.
Very interesting. I'll put those books in the show notes. If you had to do something else, what would you be doing? If law was no longer in the cards, you get fired today, what would Heather Colt be doing?
I would probably try to either be a headhunter, helping people find jobs, find the right job, or be the director of a local nonprofit. I think I would be good at either one of those things and be able to help people and find it very rewarding. I think either one of those would be a good fit.
Well, Heather, thank you so much for being on the podcast. I really do appreciate your time, and it's been a pleasure having you. Good luck to you and with your partnership at Exits Richards and your bankruptcy and commercial litigation practice. I do appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for putting the podcast out. It's a great contribution. I enjoy it a lot.